Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guest is a former U.S. Marine officer, parachutist and scuba diver, and honor graduate of the Department of Defense Information School. Robert Dean holds a journalism degree from Oregon State University and a master's degree from California State University, Chico. He founded what became California's largest independently owned public relations agency. After leaving the corporate world, Robert Dean retired to the Oregon coast, where he writes on a variety of subjects, such as business communications and a historical book focused on a high desert community in southwestern Idaho. His latest book also contains a bit of history, the history of peanuts. Robert Dean has written The Boiled Peanut Book, Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Boiled Peanuts. Robert Dean, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.
You know, I'm curious as to why you would write a book like this.
Well, a couple answers to that. One is, as this may sound a little strange, but I really am an advocate for boiled peanuts. It was something that was important to me as a child who grew up as a young child in the South, but then moved out to the Western United States where no one had ever even heard of a boiled peanut. So my whole life, I grew up sort of having positive thoughts about it, really liking them, and nobody even knew what I was talking about if I brought it up. So partly it was an educational thing.
Well, you have an interesting dedication in your book. You say you dedicate to all those people who are missing one of the greatest treats life offers. It's never too late. That's on your dedication page. But you also have a quote by Mark Twain that I liked. Do you have your book? Can you read that quote by Mark Twain?
Mark Twain, yes. 20 years from now, you will be more disappointed by the things that you didn't do than by the ones you did. So throw off the bowlines, sail away from the safe harbor, catch the trade winds in your sails, explore, dream, discover.
This is Robert Dean reading from the dedication page in his book, The Boiled Peanut Book. And I was interested in the fact that you give the history of peanuts. And I didn't know they had such a fascinating history. About the only thing I knew was the research done at by George Washington Carver. So would you tell us, and you have a section in your book about the history of, and you titled this section, The History of Peanuts. So would you tell us what peanuts are? Because they aren't perhaps what people think they are.
They're really not. And, you know, people very much associate them with the Southern South and the kind of more of a legend. I mean, it's not really a historical thing that I could give you a reference for, but people assume that peanuts came from Africa as a part of the slave trade in the early 1600s and what have you, in part because there's a native groundnut in Africa that looks very much like a peanut, and it's referred to as Naguba in the Bantu language, and they assume that's where the nickname goober peas in the South came from boiled peanuts. But in any event, the interesting thing is they're really not from Africa, not originally. They're from South America, and there are artifacts, ceramics that have been discovered shaped like peanuts that are like 3,500 years old, and they've actually found in Peru fossilized peanut hulls that are 7,600 years old. So they came from South America. How did they get back up to the Southern United States? Well,
excuse me for interrupting, yeah. Robert, but when I read that, I was surprised because I assumed just like what you've been describing, and particularly since I lived in Peru for a year and peanut butter was so hard to find, peanuts, that when people would come to visit, we would ask them, would you please bring some peanut butter with you? Come from the States. So I was surprised to learn about the peanut being depicted in ceramics because I went to the museums and saw these various things that ancient Peruvians depicted in their ceramics, but I didn't remember the peanut.
Well, you know, that's interesting. And I've been to Peru, but well, more on the Amazonian side, but I don't remember much about peanuts, but I do know that in all my researches of looking for recipes, and I found so many recipes, especially from Africa and Asia, I didn't see a single one from South America. So, you know, interesting question. I don't know.
Well, even the name, we call it a peanut, and it looks like a cashew, which is a nut from a tree. But you, what do we actually know that peanuts are not nuts at all?
Yeah, they're actually a legume. It's spelled like L-E-G-U-M-E. So they're a tuber that grows underground, and they're not nuts at all, which, by the way, is a complicating factor if you get into this section of the book on canning peanuts and preserving them. Is that, I don't know if you ever deal with canning, but you have to use a pressure cooker. You can't water can peanuts because of the acidity, and it's dangerous if you don't do it properly. So if you get around to the point of wanting to do your own thing, make sure you do that right.
Well, in fact, I saw then, well, yeah, because you describe how thoroughly you have to wash these peanuts. If you're going to boil peanuts, you have to wash them. And I think, well, yeah, they've been underground, and I never thought of it before because I eat roasted peanuts and peanuts in other forms, and you take the shell off and eat it. So that's why you have to wash. If you're going to eat boiled peanuts, if you're going to prepare them, you got to start with washing them thoroughly. They've been underground.
And that's, yeah. That's if you're lucky enough to get the real thing. And the real reason, it isn't so much that people like out in California don't want to try boiled peanuts. You just can't really get them. And that's because they have to be made, the real thing, out of freshly picked peanuts. They call them green peanuts, not raw. If you take them right out of the ground, like you were just talking about, so they have to be cleaned, you're fortunate enough to live somewhere where they're actually grown, because they don't transport and they don't keep. So,
well, and you do say that they grow well in the sandy soil and moist, warm climate of the South, and that they were introduced into the southern United States during the slave trading period of the 17th century. And it's because of this association with slavery that we often think that these peanuts came from Africa. I think most people probably do, as a food supply on slave ships. And you do tell us that this goober, said to have come from the Bantu language, mm-hmm. and their word for peanuts. And so it's surprising to learn in your book that peanuts actually came from the Americas, and some people think Central America, others Brazil or Peru. And you say the ancient Inca graves been found containing jars of peanuts.
Well, jars shaped like peanuts, not of peanuts, but shaped, you know, in a peanut form. And then also, like I say, they've found the actual holes in some of the excavations and things.
And then when the Spanish explorers came over in the 1500s, and they found all these growing peanuts, and they took samples back to Spain, where they're still grown.
That's right. Most people say the Spaniards, some say it was the Portuguese from the Brazilian side of South America. But the Spanish, and they took them back, and, you know, they became popular in Spain and Portugal. And the Spanish galleons took them into the Pacific, and then they spread out to India and Asia, you know, China, and where they're extremely popular, maybe more so than the United States.
Yeah, and you said that peanuts were rapidly welcomed into African culture because they did resemble a native groundnut, which was a subterranean legume. And then you say that the Spanish galleon spread peanuts to the Pacific Islands, the Philippines, Indonesia. And I think about Indonesian food that make a peanut sauce that is quite tasty.
That's correct. That's correct. Most of the Asian recipes or usage of boiled peanuts, it's different from America in that, one, they don't use all the salt, the process that we do. And then also they're served already shelled. I mean, just the peanut itself, and they're largely an ingredient to recipes, whereas the boiled peanut thing in the South, it's all about having them in the shell and, you know, eating them outside and spitting the shells out, and it's kind of a thing.
And you do show that the peanuts, documents show peanuts being grown for commercial use in South Carolina as early as 1800 and being used for oil, food, and a substitute for cocoa. I found it interesting when you get to the Civil War, because I thought, well, yeah, peanuts, that would be a good food for Civil War soldiers. And how did the, what role did the peanuts play in the Civil War?
Well, I dispute a little bit the historical explanation of that, because what they say is that the Confederate troops needed a food supply that they could carry with them. But boiled peanut does not keep unrefrigerated more than a day. And green peanuts don't keep. That's a part of the problem. You know, the green peanuts mold very quickly. So the only thing people would have been able to carry would have been dried peanuts. And that's what you get at the store if you buy raw peanuts or those dried things. And they're bulky. So I don't know. I mean, maybe. But the other part of the story, which maybe sounds a little more likely, you know what a picket is in the Civil War, any kind of army? A picket is like these people that are kind of like an outpost, and they're stuck out there to make sure nobody creeps up on your army. And the pickets from both sides would talk to each other, and they would exchange tobacco for this or that. And they say that that's how the Northerners first got exposed to peanuts, and more in the roasted variety, and that they took that home. And that's about the same time when baseball became big in the United States. And that was where the connection was with, you know, take me out to the ballpark and buy me the roasted peanut thing and all that, that's how that happened, which I think is interesting, although it could be, you know, anecdotal.
My guest is Robert Dean, and he formerly lived in Chico, and he has written a book, The Boiled Peanut Book. And he is telling us now about the history of the peanut. It didn't come from where you might think it came from. And I just imagine when you were talking about the Civil War soldiers, they had a backpack or rucksack full of peanuts, that would be, it would fill their whole backpack, and they wouldn't have many peanuts in once they were shelled.
Exactly. Exactly. That's just my thinking.
And you said that before 1900, peanuts weren't grown commercially because one reason, they were considered food for the poor, and that also because the process of growing and harvesting peanuts was slow and difficult. Labor-saving equipment invented around the turn of the century changed that. And peanuts are quite handy because you can, we mentioned, use them for oil. You can roast it, salted peanut butter. I mean, people might be unfamiliar with boiled peanuts, but peanut butter, I mean, that's a kid's delight. And of course, candy. But now, I did mention that one thing, as far as the history of the peanut goes, there's this outstanding figure, George Washington Carver. And what role did he play in the peanut?
Well, he is absolutely the person to put peanuts on the map, really. And he's referred to as the father of the peanut industry. And he was with the Tuskegee Institute around the turn of the century, around 1900. And he alone came up with more than 300 uses for peanuts, including making shoe polish and shaving cream and just incredible, you know, number of things to put them to good use. But and, but
that
it's
was
really
a surprise. I was surprised to hear that they'd use peanuts in shoe polish or shaving cream. And so I mentioned how versatile peanuts were. I didn't even realize how versatile they were. And then what else did Carver suggest?
Well, I think the main contribution is he was the one that suggested peanuts as a rotation crop in the South's cotton growing regions, because at the time they were threatened by the boll weevil. And I'm not an agricultural expert on that piece of it, but by using crop rotation, which simply means you put peanuts there one year and the next year it's cotton or whatever, and you rotate it around, it made a huge difference. And that's why peanuts were adopted really as a prime agricultural product in places like Georgia and Alabama and what have you. So that was really, really big.
After a break, Robert Dean and I will continue our conversation about the boiled peanut. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Chico State alumnus Robert Dean is author of The Boiled Peanut. Well, I happen to have grown up in Georgia, and many years ago, I do remember tasting boiled peanuts. I haven't had any since then. That's quite a long time. So I know Georgia was a place where boiled peanuts were eaten. I don't see them now anymore. If I go back and visit Georgia, I don't see any boiled peanuts. I even asked a friend who grew up in Arkansas, because I thought, well, Arkansas, that's deep south. Surely he was familiar with boiled peanuts. And he said, no, actually, he was not familiar with boiled peanuts in Arkansas. So I did realize in reading your book, there were certain states in the south where the peanuts could be found. And now you did mention that they're sometimes called goober peas. And it's sometimes negatively referred to as a goober, and you suggest that it's because of Goober Pyle, the gas station attendant on the Mayberry TV series.
For those who remember that.
Yeah. And then there was a song, and I do remember that tune came right back to me when you mentioned the song about goober peas. And when did that song come into being?
Well, it was a Civil War marching song. And the kind of thing that, you know, even when I was in the Marines, when people would march in the field, you'd sing these different songs and what have you. And it was a legitimate Civil War marching song that, as a matter of fact, it popped up in an episode of MASH where Hawkeye was singing it. And someone asked him, well, what is that you're singing? He goes, oh, it's an old Civil War marching song. But it's been around for a long time.
In fact, you say that some people that popularized that song during the 50s and 60s were Burl Ives, Ernie Ford, and the Kingston Trio.
Right. It was quite a hit in the 50s, 60s.
Yeah. Well, you tell us how to eat a boiled peanut. And, you know, anybody who's ever seen a boiled peanut, I don't think they find it very appealing, because even the idea of boiling a peanut soaked in water, and it seems bizarre and even repulsive because it looks slimy.
Well, I have had that. I've had friends that, you know, Californians, I remember I used to say, hey, try these. And they go, oh, that sounds horrible. It's, you know, it looks slimy. And sometimes they taste them and not like them because they just do not taste anything like a regular peanut. They're not what you expect. But I say, you know, give it a try. Do like Mark Twain said, you know, take a chance and give them a go and keep it an open mind. But when you normally eat like a roasted peanut, you open it with your hands and you shake the peanuts into your hand and pop them in your mouth and eat them. The key thing with a boiled peanut is they are full of liquid. And based on the recipe and the way they're made, that's where the taste really is at. So what you want to do is put the whole peanut in your mouth and you want to crack it just a little bit with your teeth. And then you want to suck all of that juice out first. And then you can either with your teeth or take it out of your mouth and your fingers, then you pull it all the way open and eat the peanut. So that's the critical difference in being able to eat one like a Southerner or being exposed to someone who doesn't know how to eat boiled peanuts. So there you go.
Well, one thing that persuaded me, perhaps I should give it a second look, in spite of its maybe repulsive nature, is that you tell us that boiled peanuts are actually healthier than peanuts cooked in other forms. That came as a surprise to me. And so that made me think, well, maybe I should take another look at boiled peanuts. Why are they healthier?
Just the boiling process removes certain items that aren't really good for your body. And I can't really explain the chemical part of it, but it is a scientific fact that boiled peanuts have less of the harmful things you might find in a regular peanut. However, I must be honest and say that any benefits might possibly be balanced by the fact that there is a lot of salt in boiled peanuts.
You say that they are loaded with vitamins and minerals, that they're high in plant protein, and the fat that's in boiled peanuts is primarily monounsaturated and polyunsaturated fat. And you say that boiled peanuts contain more antioxidants than roasted or raw peanuts.
That's true. That's not me, really. It's American Heart Association and the Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry and places like that. And I can't even pronounce the name of the word that the chemical that's the most helpful thing. It's called resveratrol. It's the same thing that's in red wine. Maybe you've heard people say,
resveratrol.
Yeah, if you have a glass of red wine, it's good for your heart. It's the same chemical.
That was a surprise too, because I knew about it being in red wine, resveratrol, but I did not suspect that it was in pets.
Well, who would really? But now you know.
Yeah, so they have done research on that. Another, your chapter two came as a surprise, because I guess I kind of knew there were different kinds of peanuts, but I never knew their labels. Like, I had heard of maybe Spanish peanuts, but I hadn't heard of a runner peanut. And you say that the runner peanut is the most commonly used for making peanut butter. Tell us what kinds of peanuts we can find and where we can find them.
Well, I think, you know, as you just said, the runners are the most common. They're probably the most suitable for boiling, which is my thing. But they're, you know, mostly used for peanut butter. They're a little bit sweeter than most other peanuts, which is one reason people use them for boiled. The Spanish ones, which
And even within the runners, there are a lot of different kinds of the runner peanut. And you mentioned the Spanish. You started to tell us about the Spanish peanut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're the ones with the red skins, the smaller ones with the red skins, which I like, but those are not usually used for boiling, but they are most predominantly for candy. So if you buy a chocolate bar or something with peanuts in it, it's usually going to be the Spanish ones.
Yeah, those of us who eat peanuts are familiar with that red shell.
Right.
On the outside.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're grown in different parts of the country. And like you said, they're different sort of like sub-brands, but that's just the agricultural people kind of fine-tuning. They're all basically the same.
And then I also saw Costco had some containers of huge peanuts. And so when I read your book, I saw, oh, those must have been Virginia peanuts.
I think you were probably right.
You say that's the largest of all the peanuts, and that's known as the ballpark peanut because it's often used in gourmet snacks, these big peanuts.
Mm-hmm.
And as you might guess, they are grown in Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and West Texas.
That kind of surprised me. And the interesting thing to me is the Valencias are mostly grown in New Mexico. And I don't really know why. I assume it's the climate and the soil there. But that's, you know, you don't really associate New Mexico, and at least in my mind, is a place for peanuts, but it is. Mm-mm.
That was a surprise also, that the Valencia peanut was practically mainly grown in New Mexico. And that's why it may be hard to find the Valencia peanut, because you say they account for less than 1% of U.S. production of peanuts.
Right. So that's not much.
Yeah. So the Spanish peanut we're familiar with because of the red skin on the Spanish peanut and used in candies and peanut butter. And you say it also has a reputation of the nuttiest flavor when they're roasted due to its high oil content. And the Spanish peanut, you mentioned being grown in Oklahoma and Texas, but that's only 4% of U.S. production. That was kind of a surprise. I expected it to be more, the Spanish peanut.
Because I would agree with you. I would agree with you on that. I was really surprised by that.
Your book also contains illustrations. For example, you have an illustration of a peanut plant showing these legumes, or what we call nuts, underground. And earlier you mentioned green peanuts. And I would think, well, okay, is that the same as raw peanuts?
And it is not. I mean, it's a very important factor, and it has a lot to do why it's so difficult to find boiled peanuts. They're only available during the harvest, which is right now, by the way. And, you know, okay, so just this past week, I thought, well, I want to boil my own peanuts. I can't get them here out in Oregon. So I went to the website of a farm in Georgia where they will sell you a half bushel, which is quite a few, for $40. But they have to ship them to you, FedEx overnight, because they won't keep. And it was like $75 for the shipping. So it's like an expensive process, and they don't keep unrefrigerated for more than like 36 hours. So green peanuts, which is really the best ones to use, are a difficult thing to get a hold of. And so in the book, it goes into other things. I mean, that's what I was trying to do, is to help people who aren't going to be able to, you know, buy their own. You can buy canned boiled peanuts, probably not in a local store in California, but you can order them online. You can buy raw peanuts, which are dried. They're not cooked, but they're dried. You can usually buy those in a grocery store, and you can boil your own peanuts with those, but it takes a long, long time because they are, in fact, dried. So without, I don't want to, you know, be a little boring to go into all the options, but the point of the book is that if you want to experience boiled peanuts, there's going to be a way in there, you know, to get it done. And that was kind of what I was trying to accomplish, is to help people out and should point them in the right direction, that if they want to, you know, do something adventuresome and give it a go, they'll be able to do it.
My guest is Robert Dean, and his background has nothing to do with peanuts. His background, his background is that he's a former U.S. Marine officer, a parachutist, and scuba diver. Now, there's right there your sense of adventure. And so you just dive right in adventure of eating boiled peanuts. Now, when you describe how to boil peanuts, I was amazed at how time consuming it is. My gosh, this is a real time commitment to be boiling peanuts, Robert.
Well, it takes a while. And to do the basic thing, you're probably, with green peanuts, you're probably looking at 4 hours. With the dry ones, like I mentioned, you might be looking more at 24. But I'll tell you a secret. You know, what's really great is a crock pot. You put them in a crock pot and cook them on low as long as it takes overnight. And it's really simple. You don't have to worry about anything. Do not leave a boiling pot of peanuts on your stove unattended, because that could be dangerous. But use a crock pot and it'll be simple. And you can make small batches and experiment, and that'll work just fine.
Well, you also mentioned, like other legumes, that it helps to soak them beforehand before you cook them.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's a part of the process. If you don't soak them, then you're going to have to boil them even longer. So it's a part of the softening process. And absolutely, if you try the raw dried version, just soak them in a big pot for 24 hours to get them soft.
And that's after you scrub them. You say scrub them with a brush and scrub away the dirt, and then you scoop them up and then you wash them. And
well, if you got green ones, for sure, you know, they're going to be right out of the ground. Some people grow their own. I've tried that too with mixed success. But yeah, absolutely. You got to have them clean, because although I tell you what, the boiling process is going to clean things up a lot.
I would think so. But now you mentioned that if we want these peanuts here in California, that sounds to me like the best way is to grow your own. But you say you didn't have much success doing that.
The plants grew great, but I didn't get much of a harvest. Now, I'm not an expert on growing peanuts, but you know, I was just experimenting myself, and maybe somebody else would have a better luck at it. But on the other hand, there's probably a reason why they're not growing a lot of them in Oregon and California, places like that commercially. Maybe our soil just doesn't really suit. But there's instructions if you want to try growing some, like in a pot on your patio, that kind of thing. The how-to stuff is in the book as well. But I think the better bet, if you're really just curious, just order some online. The problem with the online ordering is that peanuts are stored in water, and so they're heavy, and so you end up with, again, with big shipping costs. So, mm-hmm. you know, I try and avoid that, but just go ahead and get yourself, you know, a can or one of these vacuum seal kind of things that are for sale and give them a try. And then if you like them, then you can step up to, you know, maybe some of these other things that are bigger volume.
Yeah. You describe your book as a how to do it book, but now I have friends who are gardeners, and I'm thinking, yeah, they have talent. Maybe they'd like to pick up the challenge and try growing some peanuts here in California.
Well, I'll give you a tip. If they want to try that, don't go online and pay a bunch of money for the peanuts. Just get some that you get at a grocery store. Just make sure they're raw, because obviously anything that's been cooked won't germinate. But raw, dried peanuts, plant them in the ground and they'll grow. And I do that all the time, and it's amazing how well it works.
Well, that does sound simple.
And cheap.
Now, something that surprised me is your book has a lot of recipes. You have give a basic recipe, and you say from start to finish, allow 4 to 6 hours, and the serving size is just a cup in the shell, which is not a whole lot. But I also was surprised that you have Cajun boiled peanuts, that you have all sorts of flavoring. I never knew how many flavors of boiled peanuts you could create. Sounds like it's just only limited by your own imagination. What are some of your favorites as far as different seasonings for boiled peanuts?
Well, I like hot stuff. So first of all, I like what in the South is referred to as the Cajun spicy peanuts. And that's obviously a Cajun style of you know, spiciness. It's different from the, say, the Hispanic or Mexican style. I like things with jalapenos, the kind of the Texas recipes. I like habaneros. You know, I like the spicy stuff. Other people, they're more like on the garlic side of things. But it's a personal thing. And the beauty of it is the basic boiled peanut process and recipe is really simple. What you're able to do is by changing the spices and things you put in there, you can get a variety of different tastes and flavors, and you can come up with different things. It's very interesting. So all the boiled peanuts are cooked about the same. It's the spices that make the difference.
Well, one that caught my eye, because I happen to like Indian curry, was the garam masala boiled peanuts. And you say that they're a popular snack in India, often flavored with this, what we would consider a curry. And in fact, you mentioned these boiled peanuts are a popular snack in India. And that was surprised that boiled peanuts are enjoyed around the world. I never would have guessed that.
I was a little surprised myself, tell you the truth. I mean, and of course, I had it in my head. Oh, this is a southern, you know, south, you know, the, you know, United States thing. But it's actually, they're extremely popular, especially in Asia, but in India, like you just said. But the difference is that they don't use as much salt in the process. And often they're boiled, but then shelled and used as an ingredient in other dishes, which is what you're seeing in the Asian thing.
You have a boiled peanut soup recipe in your book, for example.
Right. And peanut ice cream, which is, you know, I mean, those are kind of novelties. I do kind of like the peanut, the boiled peanut cookies, though,
yeah,
which are a lot like peanut butter cookies.
Yeah, that sound appealing.
It's pretty easy to make, too.
My guest is Robert Dean, and he has written a book telling us about boiled peanuts. It's called The Boiled Peanut Book. And his hope is that he will entice us to try something new, if you've never had a boiled peanut, is to try boiling your own peanuts. And you mentioned festivals that take place at various times. And I was surprised that the very first, if I want to call it a festival, takes place just 2 hours from where I grew up, and I never knew about it. And this was in Blakely, Georgia.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's heart of peanut country.
Yeah. And so there are these peanut festivals that people celebrate peanuts.
Yeah, that's kind of a sad thing, because I was going to go to the South on kind of like a tour during the harvest season, which is when most of these festivals are. And they all got pretty much canceled because of the COVID stuff this year. So I'm hoping things will go back to normal and, you know, be able to do that next year. But yeah, it's like so many things, you know, they had to basically cancel them out for this year until things get back to normal. But when they're back, they're a lot of fun.
Well, I mentioned that was only 2 hours from where I live. Another part of the peanut history was very close to me, and that's America's Georgia. And why did that come to the forefront in the peanut industry?
Oh, you mean Jimmy Carter?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Jimmy Carter. And he is right in the heart of peanut country. He was and is a peanut farmer. And I actually liked his brother Billy's beer, if you can remember back to, when he was president. But Jimmy Carter is, you know, forever associated with peanuts, and always will be. And that's right there in the heart, Plains, Georgia.
The home of President Carter was Plains, Georgia. And you say that festival features fun runs, parade, educational exhibits. And I was surprised to learn that there are museums. And again, this wasn't far from where I grew up either. I wish I had known about those things. I could have attended a peanut museum and learned there. Now, I mentioned you have recipes in your book and festivals. You also have song lyrics in your book, Robert. Mm-hmm. And it brought back memories for me that I didn't even know about. And you mentioned the song about goober peas. And I thought, yeah, I know that. I have no idea where I heard that. It might have been when I went to summer camp in the summers. We might have sung peas, eating goober peas. Goodness, how delicious, eating goober peas. And the lyrics go along with Civil War. Another one The tune is familiar, and I had never really realized that. And I have no idea where I heard this song. It may have been at camp. Found a peanut, found a peanut, found a peanut just now. I just now found a peanut just now. And it goes on. Now, what are some of the other lyrics in that one?
Well, you sing that pretty good, a lot better than I could. But I remember these from when I was a little boy in Georgia, my mother singing that to me as a lullaby. So
it's sung to a familiar tune. I didn't make the connection until you say that it, the tune of Clementine.
Right.
And then the lyrics go on, cracked it open, cracked it open. And then after that verse, it was rotten, it was rotten. And then the next verse, ate it anyway, ate it anyway. And then it goes on to, got a stomach ache, got a stomach ache. Call the doctor, call the doctor. And it goes on. And I thought, gosh, this is a strange song.
I don't think it's the kind of song you would sing to your kids nowadays.
don't think so.
But it's actually pretty funny, but it's an old one.
It's actually a funny song. Yeah.
Yeah, that is good. But you do that well.
Well, I think as a parting thought, we might remind people that boiled peanuts are good for us. Any other parting thoughts you'd like to leave us with, Robert?
I just think that people, should give it a try. You get so much of that kind of just, I've never eaten one, but I never will because I know I won't like it. Just, give it a try and you might really, really be surprised.
Like Mark Twain says, explore, dream, discover, sail away from the safe harbor. Catch the trade winds in your sails. So people might take a different view of their peanuts now, thanks to your book, Robert.
Thank you.
My guest was Robert Dean. After a break, award-winning author Pam Houston describes a sky burial she witnessed in Tibet. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Author Pam Houston teaches at UC Davis and directs the literary nonprofit Writing by Writers. She has won the Western States Book Award, the Willa Award, the Evil Companions Award, and multiple teaching awards. She's the author of two collections of linked short stories, Cowboys Are My Weakness and Waltzing the Cat, a novel, Sight Sound, and the essay collection, A Little More About Me. Her stories have been selected for volumes of Best American Short Stories, the O. Henry Awards, the 2013 Pushcart Prize, and Best American Short Stories of the Century. Her most recent book is Contents May Have Shifted. Pam Houston, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, you travel an awful lot, according to this book that you wrote.
I do.
And the character in your book, amazingly enough, is named Pam.
Coincidentally.
Coincidentally,
she is.
And you are Pam Houston. So, is this character you?
Yeah. I mean, to answer simply, yeah. It's a much more complicated answer, of course, than that. For me, writing has always been about paying really strict attention out in the world to things that happen. And, of course, a lot of stuff happens when I travel. And coming home and writing it down and shaping it into story. And I've never been that concerned with representing an event as it absolutely actually happened. I often I do. Like often the way it happened is the very best way to tell the story. But I'm also about shaping it and making it have kind of structural integrity and aesthetic integrity. So for me, writing fiction has always been taking my lived experience and shaping it on the page. And in recent years, with the rise of nonfiction and memoir, something that people are now wanting to read, there's just been a lot of attention to this line between fiction and reality and the reality police. And I've just never been one to like say, no, this really happened to me. I don't care about that. But by the same token, all of these trips, you know, these 144 little moments that make up this book were very important to me, to the consciousness that is me. And so I didn't feel right calling her Melanie or Lucy. You know, I wanted to call her me. So this book is very intentionally sitting on the line between fiction and memoir and really calling into question how definite that line can be because of the failure of language to mean and because of the failure of memory and because of all the things we wish we said, you know. So it's part of a conversation about whether this fiction, nonfiction line can be as hard as fast as some people want it to be.
My guest is Pam Houston, and we're talking about her book, Contents May Have Shifted. And that's a phrase, if you've ever flown, you've heard the stewardess say that, or they don't call them stewardesses now.
Sorry, flight attendants.
Flight attendants.
Yes.
Contents may have shifted. So you do a lot of traveling.
I do a lot of traveling. And when I was looking for a title for this book, I knew I wanted it to be flight language of some kind, you know. And it was funny because I read the Boeing manual. I read the entire Air Force Code of Conduct. Like, I was looking for all these airplanes. And then it turned out that I just called it something that I hear 100 times a year, 200 times a year, every time the plane comes down.
Well, people are probably wondering, Pam, you just travel, because your world is a big world. You travel all over the world. Mm-hmm. And in your book, this is a quote from your book, "These days, Rick wonders if I'll ever grow up enough to realize that everything I'm searching for on the other side of the world, I could find just as well at my own kitchen table." And then what did you tell him? You remember what you replied?
I believe I say something like, yeah, maybe, except I can't.
That's it. I said, maybe someday. I say cheerfully, except that I can't. And I can see his point of view,
right.
You know, when
sure.
people go looking all over the world for something that's in their own backyard.
Right.
But the adventure you have, you could not get sitting at your kitchen table.
Yeah. You know, I don't have children. And a friend of mine once said to me, well, when you look in your baby's eyes, trying to convince me to have children, mm-hmm. she said, when you look in your baby's eyes, it'll be just like Tibet. And I think, well, it might be wonderful. It might be more wonderful, but it's not one thing it's not going to be is Tibet, right? Because only Tibet is Tibet. And, you know, I was just born with this desire to go, you know, to go and see, and the more different, the better. And, you know, I went to Bhutan the year it opened when no one had been to Bhutan. I mean, for me, it's always about the other and the difference and what can be, you know, what can I learn over there? What can I be shown in these places? And, you know, these places, it can be Bhutan, it can be Cambodia, it can be Baffin Island in the Canadian Arctic, or it can be South Dakota, you know, which happens to be a place I love. You know, it doesn't have to be far-flung, but the more other it is, the more my eyes are open and the more ripe it is for being written about.
Well, one of the stories you tell are something that so few of us could even possibly imagine experiencing, and you were able to witness a sky burial.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
I was traveling in Tibet with a very good outfitter from San Francisco, a company called Geographic Expeditions, and they just are very good at making local connections and using local guides and getting people into places that are hard to get into. And so I did have the amazing good fortune of being invited to a sky burial at a monastery where we went to the monastery and then we walked up to the top of the hill. And this monastery is where the Tibetans know to bring their loved ones who they want to have a sky burial. So the day we were there, there was actually three bodies and about 250 vultures. And in less than 5 minutes, the bodies were unwrapped. The vultures were let into the space where the bodies were, kind of the bier, I guess you would call it. And lots of screeching and squawking and chomping. And all that was left was skulls and pelvises, you know, in just a matter of minutes. And then the monk goes in and pounds the skulls and pelvises with a giant mallet, and then the birds come in again. And, you know, the idea being, of course, that the person ascends to the sky, which is where the Tibetans want their ancestors to go. And it was incredibly powerful and also sort of festive. You know, it's not somber.
That would be surprising, I would think.
It's a little festive because it's the happiness of getting them up into getting their spirits up into the sky. It's not somber, but it's serious. And the fact that I was there meant to my guides that I had to be cleansed. I had to go into a stupa and get smudged.
Stupa. Now, let's make sure it's not stupa. But
No, a stupa, a little hut, and had to get my whole body. I thought I would die of asphyxiation before they would let me out of there because I had to be cleansed. It was very, very dangerous to them that a white person was invited and was allowed to be there. And I felt bad about it. I didn't know that's how it would be. And my one guide thought, you know, the car might crash because I had been allowed to come. And so they tried really hard to get everything off of me with smoke, the bad luck that I might have picked up by being at this ceremony. But it was one of the most powerful things I've ever seen.
Well, this, by the way, my guest is Pam Houston, and she has written a book, a series of vignettes, 144 of them, that describe her travels all over the world, her experiences. And this one you mentioned is a somber one. So why don't you read us one of your lighter vignettes?
All right.
What about the when you ate the antibacterial wipe?
Okay. This is... This one is number 25. It's called Ban Zhang Hai Laos. My guide Zai and I are standing in the warm mist of a Mekong River morning in the village of Ban Zhang Hai Laos, watching an unusually tall Laotian tend his boiling vats of lau lau, the rice wine moonshine that has put his village on the map. Monkeys scream in the trees above us, and a gentle-faced woman stands nearby, holding a glass I fear is meant for me. It is slightly after 8 a.m., and in America, that would be good enough reason to decline politely. But here in Laos, where decorum is far more rigorous and complicated than it is in America, I'm pretty sure there isn't going to be a way out of drinking the pickled Mekong water that is about to come from the steaming, rusted 50-gallon drum. I reassure myself that no self-respecting amoeba could possibly live in 80-proof hooch, and quickly down the glass of white I am offered, which gets me another glass, and then a glass of red, which I realize the second it goes down my throat without searing my tonsils isn't nearly as strong as the white. I am seized with regret, flooded by premonitions of feverish vomiting in a Laotian healthcare facility. I do what any sophisticated world traveler would do and stuff an entire antibacterial wipe into my mouth, and during the tour of the brightly painted temple, suck every drop of juice out of it I can and swallow.
This is Pam Houston reading from her collection of vignettes. Contents may have shifted. And you have one essay vignette.
Yes.
Called How Travel Makes You Feel Better. I don't know if we'll have time for all of it, but would you start reading that, Pam?
Oh, sure, sure, sure.
Yeah.
Climbing off the tarmac up into the bright red and orange four-seater owned by Wrangell Mountain Air, there are just enough clouds, I know, of the big white puffy variety to create shadows that will make these most spectacular of all mountains even more spectacular. I have had the good fortune to circle Denali in a small plane, to fly into and out of the Himalayas, riding in the cockpit both directions. But these mountains, the Wrangells and the Chugach and the St. Elias, rising from sea level all the way to the peak of Mount St. Elias at 18,008 feet in 10 short miles, glacier after glacier after mountain make them, in my opinion, the most dramatic in all the world. This plane will take me to the other side of the Wrangles, north of the Chugach, close to the Yukon border by anybody's measuring stick, one of the world's most remote locations. There I will ride reluctant horses through boggy tundra, listen to eager hunting guides play the washtub and the spoons around the fire, keep my eyes and ears peeled for brown bears, and try to teach six Alaskan women and one man from Nova Scotia how to write. William from Halifax and I drove the long road from Chitna into McCarthy together. He is tall, handsome, moderately literary, tow-headed, and still very much hung up on his ex-wife. Something about the way our conversation turned us inevitably back to her 6,000 or 7,000 times in 3 hours has thrown me deep into abject loneliness, which lately has been a pretty short trip. When I left on this month-long adventure, Ethan gave me a Mike Schmidt baseball card and dangling poet earrings, black on black. Now the woman who lives in his cell phone says, "Ethan is not available," with just a hint of impatience in her voice. I am up front, next to the pilot, Halifax William behind me, a woman from Juneau next to him, our three packs taking up every inch of space in the tail. The pilot turns the plane in a tight circle. We accelerate and lift off, and before he has even pulled in the flaps, the first glacier is in front of us, huge and dirty and violent with stretch marks, plunging out of the cloud cover and into the shimmering sun. Instantly, I feel that old surge come back, that seizing of my own life on my own terms. It is such a physical thing. Like the time I had my forearm shattered and the nurse came in every 4 hours on the dot to give me a shot of morphine, that's how physical. And I look down at the glacier and the ice-ridged peaks that go on forever behind it and say, remember this, remember this, remember this the next time you think it's over because some man or some hope or some life takes away instead of gives. Remember this and get on an airplane, a small one if possible, because it always works.
My guest is Pam Houston, and she is an award-winning writer. She came to Chico in the past to offer tips on writing when she was invited by Butte College to their Word Spring conference. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Pam, about your book.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Pam Houston, and she is author of Contents May Have Shifted.
I'd also like to thank my first guest, Robert Dean, author of The Boiled Peanut Book.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.